time now for the nationally syndicated radio show, The World of Lori Zook. And now, here she is, the smart, the sexy, the savvy, Divine Miss C.
And welcome to the show, and thanks for joining me today. I have special guest Elmer Hopper with me today for this Masters and Legends Part 3 special. Elmer, I want to thank you for being my guest. We have a lot to talk about, and I'll just let you know as a side note, you're the only guest that I've actually done three shows with, because your story I just found to be so interesting. In the first show, we didn't even get into the music, but in the second show, we got a little bit into the music. So today we're going to talk a lot more about the music, right?
Wonderful. Thank you for having me again. This is so exciting.
You're welcome. Well, let's talk about the Platters. Let me just have you first give a little history of how you got into the Platters, and then we're going to talk about some of the music.
Okay, really good. Well, I joined the Platters in 1974. I was actually at a house party when I met Mr. Roby. I had no idea. He just told me his name was Paul. And I had a guitar there, and I started playing the guitar. And he asked me, he said, can you actually play that thing, or are you just holding it? And so we started off singing a tune by the Stylistics. And he opened the part. It was that song called You Make Me Feel Brand New. And the way he sang it was just unbelievable. I never sat next to someone who could sing that good. And that was basically the start. He heard my voice, and I told him that I had just written a song for the Miracles. And that was really busy. And he said, well, I'm going to go out of town for a couple of weeks. When I get back, I want to talk to you. I want to give you a call. And so I gave him my number, and I thought I'd probably never hear from him again in life. And he did actually call me a couple of weeks later, and he said, this is Paul. I met you over at that house party. And I was so surprised to hear from him. And he said, well, what are you doing today? I said, well, I'm just here at my studio. And he said, well, I want to come by and have a look at what you got going, and let's talk. And that was pretty much the start of my introduction to him.
Okay. Now, you ended up joining the Platters.
Well, how it happened was, I started off, when I got to his house, he invited me to a rehearsal, and I didn't realize what was going on. He just told me to come by his house, and he wanted to talk to me and introduce me to some of the people he works with. And at that time, they were planning on going on another trip, and he had me sit in on the session, and as soon as they walked in this room, he sat at the piano, and he gave different notes to everybody, and he started off with Only You, and I said, oh my God, I remember that song. I actually hated that song because when I was a little boy, I had scarlet fever, and I was in bed, and my mother played that record it was a 78. She played it over and over, like throughout the day, so much that I just hated it. And I remembered it, and I thought, well, it's interesting because my ear, I had been studying guitar, and I could sing a little bit back then. And it just didn't have a certain timbre to it, a pitch that threw me. And so then they passed the song up. They did Only You. And then they went into working with the woman who was going to work with them on this trip. And they went over a song called Help Me Make It Through the Night. I thought, oh, that's a good song. I remember that. I still had no idea that Paul was related in any way to the Platters. I had no idea. And they took a break, actually, and I said to a couple of them, Paul left the room to go get a cigarette. And I said to one of the guys in the group, I said, you guys sound really good. What do you call yourself? And they all started like laughing and said, Paul didn't tell you who he was? And I thought, well, no, he didn't. He said, man, Paul is one of the original founders of the Platters vocal group. And I said, I'll be darned. That's it.
Yeah.
That's why you did Only You.
Yeah.
So anyway, he came back in the room, and I said, Paul, you didn't tell me you were part of the Platters. He said, you didn't ask. And so, interestingly, I sat there now paying more close attention, but once again, my ear wasn't that fine-tuned, but I knew that he was singing the songs like in a lower pitch. Well, it turns out that Paul was the original baritone and vocal arranger of the Platters, Tony Williams was the lead singer. So I sat, listened to the rehearsal, and they were so good. They were putting me to sleep with their harmonies. So after they finished the rehearsal, Paul said, Elmer, stick around, man. I want to ask you a couple of questions, you know, and I got a couple of ideas for you. So everybody left. I shook their hands, and they all cut out. And he said to me, Elmer, what do you think about this, man? I got an idea. How about I pay half the rent in your studio, and you learn my music on guitar, and when I do a show around town, I want you to rehearse the band and play guitar on the show. And I thought, wow, that's great. I mean, it was like to me, I said, so what do I do? What do I do to earn my part? And he says, no, I'll pay half the rent in your studio if you learn my music, and when I do a show in town, play behind us. I went immediately to a guy I was studying guitar with, and I showed him the folder he gave me with all the Platters tunes in it. And my guitar teacher was a guy by the name of Al Mitchell. Al said to me, young man, you're getting ready to learn some real music now, boy. And it was just the start of so many beautiful things. The problem was, and I have to mention this, because it was about 6 months, 7 months later, till unannounced, Paul calls me and says, Elmer, what are you doing, man? And I said, I'm just here with my son. My little boy was almost, I think, about 3 months old then. And he said to me, what are you doing? And I said, just here. He says, you want to do a show with me tonight? And I said, yeah, I'd love to. And I thought, oh, God, maybe my mother will watch my son for me. So I had to make arrangements. He came by, picked me up, and he took me to this nightclub. And Joe Houston was a tenor player. I don't remember his tunes, but he had some hits. He was also recorded under Mercury Records. So somehow or another, you know, Platters were with Mercury, and they were all old friends. So anyway, Joe Houston's band these guys were seasoned players. They were also the backup band that would play behind the Platters. So I passed out the charts. A few of the guys kind of said to me, man, I don't need this. I know all their songs. And I had been studying those songs like crazy. You know what I mean?
Yeah, you had a lot to learn.
I had a lot to learn in a different era and a whole different feel of music. And those guys just looked at it like, no, no problem. I played this before. So we finished the show. It was a good show. I was probably the weakest link. I knew what I was doing, but I didn't know exactly, all of the major cues and stuff yet.
The nuances.
Yeah. And so, interestingly, after the show, we're riding back, Paul and I, and so I waited for, I listened to him talk about, yeah, man, you know, Joe Houston, man, he was my partner, man. That was really my friend. And he was one of the only guys that actually got Buck Rams, got him back for taking advantage of people like he did. And he said, man, I think he got a brand new Cadillac and some cash. And Buck didn't have no idea where he was after he got this stuff. So I waited a minute, we're headed toward my house now. And I said, Paul, so how much did I earn tonight? No, I said, how did I do? How did I do? And he says, yeah, you did okay, man. It sounded pretty good, man. I know he couldn't listen to me and pay attention to what I was doing. He was just listening to his cues and his jokes and, narrating the show. So I said, so how much did I earn tonight? And he looked at me and said, man, you just learning. He kind of laughed. You learning. And I thought, yeah, but I've been studying this music day in and day out, all the time. And so we got to my house. And I said, well, listen, I'll talk to you soon, okay? I got out of the car. And I thought, damn, I didn't make any money. And I need some gas money for my car. In those days, I smoked cigarettes. I need a pack of cigarettes. And he stopped. He backed up. He said, hey, man, you did a great job. He said, remember, we made a deal. I don't know if you remember. I said, you know what, Paul? I am so sorry. You're right. And I totally forgot about it because it was a natural instinct to go somewhere and play and
earn money.
Get paid. Yeah.
Right. But he was giving you a good opportunity, a stepping stone, so to speak.
He told me once, he said, Elmer, you couldn't get this in Juilliard.
Yeah, you got the real life experience.
Yeah, the hands-on, I mean, right there. And it was like to stand next to him and watch him work was more than I ever even imagined during those days. And it's funny how when you're young, you take things like that for granted, you know.
Right.
And so anyway, he gave me like $20, and he said, yeah, I'll see you tomorrow down at the studio. And I said, Paul, no, don't keep it, man. He said, no, I want you need a few dollars, man. And he gave it to me, drove off, and I thought, wow, how stupid of me. You know, I just totally forgot about the idea, how I was like floating in air when he said, yeah, all you got to do is learn my music and I'll pay half the rent. And the rent was always due.
Yeah, yeah.
That studio rent was always due.
Well,
so, yeah, that was pretty much how I got started. And it was about, we did a lot of shows where I rode with him and his wife, and sometimes even with his kids and him. They went to like a couple of resorts around, and I, you know, played the guitar and with the bands. And I have to say, most of the bands I played with were much better musicians and more experienced than I ever was, you know. But it was a good learning thing. So finally he asked me, how would I like to go to Japan with them? And I thought, okay, I would love to. I've never been on a plane before. So long story short, his wife came with him to my studio, and she asked me, would I like to go? And I said, well, if you don't mind, I'd like to call my mother and have her come down and talk with us about this.
Yeah.
Because my mother was my everything. She was my attorney. She was my mentor. She was so awesome, you know. And so my mother came down, and we all talked, and she said, well, you know what, this is going to be a good opportunity for him. And I kind of felt like a big baby there, but I couldn't afford to hire an attorney or somebody look over a contract or anything. And that's just how I had to do it.
That's all right. Well, it worked. I don't want you to go anywhere. We're going to take a quick break, and we'll be back with Elmer Hopper from The Platters in just a moment.
Heavenly shades of night are falling. It's twilight time. Out of the mist, your voice is calling. 'Tis twilight time. When purple-colored curtains mark the end of day, I'll hear you, my dear, at twilight time.
Central Payment, your number one credit card merchant service provider in the industry. Providing e-commerce solutions, POS systems, standalone terminals, mobile apps, and much more, call Central Payment's James Carner at 813-777-4332. Looking for the lowest rates in the industry and number one customer service? Call Central Payment's James Carner at 813-777-4332. That's James Carner, 813-777-4332.
Do you suffer from back, neck, or body pain? Do you suffer from migraines or have jaw or face pain? Has conventional medicine failed you? Were you injured or in an accident? Call chiropractic physician Dr. Dan Maddock at 813-935-1664. Dr. Dan has helped thousands of patients gain relief for more than 30 years. Dr. Dan is caring, gentle, and takes his time with each patient. He's also a past president of the International Craniopathic Society, a special certification of only 300 chiropractors worldwide. Dr. Dan helps patients from the neck up and the neck down. Dr. Dan accepts most insurance plans. Don't continue to live in pain. Call 813-935-1664. 1664 today. That's 813-935-1664, and get on track to better health.
My prayer is to linger at the end of the day in a dream that's divine. My prayer
Welcome back to the world of Lori Zook. I've got Elmer Hopper from The Platters with me. Elmer, tell me about that song. That was you singing, right?
You played Twilight Time as it went out. That song was the song that I had to ask Paul, what did you guys do in terms of clarity? And he says, well, you know, they had just moved into what they call stereo, and it's no longer mono recordings. And he said, Tony was not only a great singer, Tony was a recording artist. And I, it stumped me. I thought, what do you mean recording artist? I thought that's what the singers were. You're an artist. He said, no, Tony could paint the words so clearly as he was singing it, like he was a painter. And I thought, wow, that's so amazing. And to ever reach that level, which I think you're born with that God-given blessing. And Tony was just one of the most incredible singers I've ever heard. I've listened to so many people, from Sinatra to Nat King Cole, and an artist like Sarah Vaughan with range you wouldn't believe. But Tony had this clarity that he would enunciate so perfectly. So I always tried to do that. And just when you played my version of My Prayer there, it was a crummy recording. But I was getting it. I was understanding to not think of what word comes next, but to say the word in such a way. And there's certain things, like Tony could go in and out of falsetto and go right into his natural voice. And his natural voice would be perfectly high in the sense of a lyric tenor voice, you know. And then when he added that falsetto in between phrases that took him into the next word, he was just incredible.
That had to be hard to do, because if you're going from falsetto, a very high voice, down to a tenor, a low voice, you've got that huge gap in between.
You either have it or you don't. There's a lot of people. Paul used to say things like, "Yeah, man, when you put that little curly Q in there, you know." And I thought, "Curly Q? What do you mean?" And I said, "You know what I thought a curly Q was? I thought it was like when you go, oh, 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 you know, like." He said, "Well, that's it." But he said, "Take that and refine it. Just, you know, like think about the word you said, like if it's." Only you, you know, put that little, that let the word say itself, only you. And I was so, you know, I was learning so much, it was just like overwhelming. And he was such a stickler of certain types of feel and enunciation that it was perfect for me, because I was doing what I thought was a good job at, like, Smokey Robinson type songs, you know, Ooh Baby Baby, and those things were in strictly falsetto. So I had a good start with falsetto, but when I couldn't imagine the key signatures and the range of some of the songs that they recorded. One of the other songs that Tony used a falsetto in was Red Sails in the Sunset. And the second time around, it, you know, you go through Red Sails in the Sunset, way out in the sea. Well, the second time it comes back, it jumps a whole key higher. So you have to go, Red Sails in the Sunset. And the way he did it was like unbelievable. Nobody could do that.
Yeah, that's huge range.
It was he was so incredible, and I could only just try and imagine and pray that I could, you know, deliver a song like he could, because I listened once. I recorded a version of Harbor Lights, and this track apparently was done by studio musicians, and it sounded identical to the original track. And I had a very good microphone and, you know, a whole lot, I call it letting alone. I was by myself, and I called it a whole lot of letting alone.
Okay.
And I was by myself, and I thought, I want to do this song as clear and the best that I can, and I don't want to try to change anything. I want it to be correct. Correct meaning that's one way they did it, and if you're great, you can change it if you have that style and you have the whatever it is, the it that you need to have in order to make something a signature tune. And I came so close in so many ways because I had to think without the coaching and the guidance. When people recorded back in those days, there wasn't just a musical director. There was vocal coaches. There were conductors. There were people who were arrangers. And there were people who knew the arrangement of any song that you would record way better than you did. And so I had to imagine that someone was there saying, okay, Elmer, I want you to go, I saw the harbor lights. And I did that over and over and over until I felt what it was. When you say certain words, you have to visualize them to be not just that word, but it's a feel of the music, and it's also something that you just make pretty. Like, I saw the harbor lights. They only told me we were partying. And the way that phrase goes, it was just, it's just something that has to be done in that style, perfection that, in heart, you know?
Yeah, that makes you feel the story of what the singer is singing rather than, you know, a lot of people I think who sing don't do it without, they don't visualize, they're just out there singing the words, they don't feel the song. And what you're trying to do is sing the song with the feeling that's in it so that the listeners relate exactly to what you're feeling.
Exactly. And that's what they used to do more than they do these days. I think music these days are done with what they call groove and feel and popular sense of recording songs that mean what, you know, like words. There's a lot of words that I don't even understand that people use in music nowadays, and I don't know if they're even thinking about what those words are. So there were so many restrictions and things, guidelines for me to follow. And to when I thought about it years later, I was trying to emulate one of the greatest singers that was ever recorded during that time. And it was said that Tony Williams was compared to some of the greatest tenor singers of all times. During his time of recording between 1955 and 1960 with the Platters.
Okay.
So, yeah, if I made any mistakes, I didn't take it so bad because greatness is really what it is, and that's greatness.
Right.
So I can only hope to work that hard.
Right. Well, I think you're great. You know, you translate exactly what you're feeling when I watch the videos of you and I'm listening, I can feel it. You know, and I think that's what defines greatness from just the average, ordinary singer.
Yeah. Well, I had a lot of, I always had this, Paul told me, whenever you're singing certain people's music, believe me, he said, there's like a shadow of them over your head. And I always had this feeling, one of these days, I'm going to be somewhere working with Paul, and Tony Williams is going to walk into the place. And just stand there and stare at me, and I would melt.
I think you would do just fine. Well, I want to ask you about movies, because didn't the Platters also appear in several movies?
They did. And do you know, the first time that I ever saw some of those movies, I was in Florida. I was in Jacksonville, Florida. There was a huge concert outside. And it was hosted by Popeye's Chicken. On this show was the Beach Boys, the Four Tops, and the Platters. And just outside the green room, it was all outdoor, big, right on the water, and there were boats that were out, you know, like sitting out in the water, you know, anchor dropped, and they're waiting for everybody to come on and perform. And they had these huge monitors, and they were showing clips of the movies that the Platters were in. One was called Carnival Rock. One was called Rock All Night. There was another one called The Girl Can't Help It. And The Girl Can't Help It, Paul wrote a song, he and Tony Williams, called You'll Never, Never Know. And Little Richard did the title track, The Girl Can't Help It, The Girl Can't Help It. But Paul's song, he said he wrote it with Tony Williams. The bass singer started off and he says, You'll never know. And Tony would go, You'll never, never know I care. It was such a good song. And when I asked Paul if we could add that song to our show, since he actually wrote it, you know, he said, man, we haven't done that since Tony was in the group. Don't mess it up. But, yeah, they were in a lot of nice movies. I haven't seen all of them. And it was so funny because as I was standing there next to Paul watching these clips from movies, he said, oh, my God. He said, you know, I've never seen this movie. He said, I remember just being on the set, and we would do our part, and that would be it.
And leave. They're probably too busy to watch it. But don't go anywhere, Elmer. We're going to go to a quick commercial break, and we'll be back in just a moment. We'll go out with some of your music.
Okie dokie.
Oh, tell me the words that I'm longing to know.
Are you looking for an affordable way to advertise to thousands of consumers nationally? If you own a business and didn't think you could afford radio advertising, you need to call me, Lori Zook, host of the nationally syndicated radio show, The World of Lori Zook. My show reaches thousands of people on 29 AM and FM stations nationwide, as well as through the internet. Additionally, your commercials will also be heard on all of my podcasts and throughout social media sites. Don't wait another minute. Call me at 813-777-4908. 813-777-4908, and let me bring your message to the nation and to help you gain more exposure.
Remember when I first met you, my lips were so afraid to say I love you. Remember when, to my surprise, the heaven in my heart leaped into yours.
And welcome back, my guest Elmer Hopper from the Platters. Elmer, we're having a good time here. Got a lot to talk about. The Platters also had 40 charting singles on the Billboard Hot 100 chart between 1955 and 1967. That was pretty much before your time, though, correct?
That's right.
Okay. And now I know that the Platters also did their own arrangements of songs. So why don't you talk about what an arrangement is and then maybe talk about some of those arrangements?
Okay. I have a good example of that answer for that question. I got a chance to meet David Carroll. This guy's name was Nook Schreier, and he changed his name to David Carroll. David was an in-house arranger for Mercury Records, and a guy, he was the lead singer of the group called the Diamonds, and his name right now just kind of escapes me, but he was the nicest guy. I met him on tour, and he gave me a contact number for David Carroll. David Carroll was 93 years old, which, by the way, I want to mention, today my father turned 93.
Oh, happy birthday to him. And I know it was your birthday a week ago, so happy birthday to
you,
too.
Yeah, we're both getting old. He's getting younger, I'm getting older. But David Carroll was in such I mean, mindset, he was incredible. And David was so humble to ask me, you know, I asked him if I could come and meet with him. He said, listen, come on by anytime you want. He was working for the Smothers Brothers. Anyway, he told me that one of the biggest treats for him was to go to Paris, France, with the Platters. And he said the biggest thing about that trip was that I got to meet with Quincy Jones to pick up some arrangements from Quincy to record Dinah Washington, who was also at that time on the Mercury label. And so I asked him, I said, well, let me ask you this. I said, what did you think of the Platters then? And he said, they were a bunch of nice kids. And I thought, wow. They were like, they were gods to me. I mean, harmony and style, and they were so groomed. And he said, they were a bunch of nice kids. And I said, well, did you realize when you did the arrangement to Smoke It's in Your Eyes that it was going to be so unique and such a great hit? He says, honest to goodness, he says, I never really gave a lot of thought to that song. It was pretty much like a stock arrangement.
Okay.
So all the magic that happened was strictly Paul coaching Tony through that song, how they would do all the parts that they did, adding that bolero and adding all of the vocal things they did. David said that it was a stock arrangement, meaning that it was just something very simple for him. So when it depends on, you know, arrangements, there was a song, it was called My Prayer. The Platters re-recorded it. It was done originally by the Ink Spots, and they just had a cello and a guitar introduction that went boom, 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 boom. And he just says, my prayer is to linger with you. And Paul wrote this part that went, when the twilight is gone and no songbirds are singing. And they put this whole front on there, and he called it actually a call. And I said, what do you mean when you say it's a call? He says, well, if you could picture a person standing on a mountain and he's calling out to people, that's kind of what that was all about before it went into, my prayer is to linger with you. It was their introduction. So that was part of an arrangement that made the Platters version of My Prayer so different from the Ink Spots.
Gotcha. Okay. Now, I know you're actually only a few years older than me, but you were born a few years before me. You were born in the 50s. And so you were little, really, when rock and roll came out.
Yes.
You know, what was the public's reaction? You know, because I've heard stories, you know, from my parents, for example, who were born in the 40s. Talk about that reaction to rock and roll and to the Platters type of music.
Well, the best answer that I could give to that is one of my buddies, who was a very brilliant pianist, said to me that he remembered as a little boy when Smoke It's in Your Eyes came out, and he said he was at a friend's house who had gotten a brand new train set for Christmas. And he said, we two were sitting on the floor playing with these trains, and in the other room, the parents put on Smoke It's in Your Eyes. And he said, we were two little boys, and we said, we stopped, and we just froze. We just listened to this magnificent recording.
Gotcha.
And I thought, wow, for a little kid,
yeah.
I remember Harbor Lights. I barely remembered The Great Pretender. And when I started listening to the radio as I got older, I heard a lot of their songs on the oldies station. You know, but my mother played, she had an album called The Platters Encore of Golden Hits, and I just remember looking at that album for so many years because she kept it on our mantle. So it's so hard because I was so young that I don't remember the impact of, you know, like Twilight Time, and that was like 1958, so hey, I was a toddler in those days.
Right, right. I remember my father used to love singing The Great Pretender. That's how I knew the song, because he used to sing it in the car all the time when we were driving. So that's how I kind of, listened to those songs and kind of fell in love with that style of music. Now, let me ask you about the Platters, because, you know, I've read quite a bit. I know there are different Platters groups. We kind of talked about that in the last show. Does anyone own the rights to the Platters name, or is it divided up? I mean, that must have been difficult.
I'm going to say what I heard. I have a documentary that this lady from Denmark came here and she filmed. She did a segment on this guy who was the attorney for Herbert Reed of the Platters. Herb was the last living member of the Platters. He says that Herb signed everything over to him. As a power of attorney, gave him everything, the rights to use the trademark name the Platters. So I'm going to leave it sit there in his hands, because he claims that he owns the name, which is fine with me. I never, I was told that I had common law rights to use the name the Platters. So the only thing that I have in mind in life to use the Platters name is mentioning the Platters in my book.
Gotcha. Okay. Well, tell me about the book. I didn't know you're writing a book.
The book is called That Magic Touch, and it's called My Life and Times with the Platters. And I start my book off by writing about the fact that I'm not re-educating the audience or the world about the history of the original Platters. I knew Zola Taylor very well. I did a show with her, actually. Tony Williams, I used to talk to him on the phone a lot before he passed, and I spent 15 years with Paul Robey before he died. Basically, my book is about stories that those folks told me and experiences that I had traveling with people like Chuck Berry, Bo Diddley, Little Anthony, Chubby Checker, and other artists. The list goes on and on. And each time that I got a chance to actually have my turn to talk to these guys, I always made sure that I didn't sound like a fan out of the audience. For instance, we did a show. It was in Bakersfield, California. It was with Ricky Nelson, who featured the original Jordanaires singing background, and Fats Domino was on the show. And so just before the show, about a half hour, Paul said, let's go over and say hi to Fats. And I was like tickled, because I knew the guy who lived in my neighborhood, originally from New Orleans, who gave Fats Domino that name.
Okay, how did he get that name? You know I'm going to ask that now.
Yes, okay. So they were doing a show. It was called Billy Diamond's, whatever they called himself. Billy Diamond was a bass player who became eventually Fats Domino's manager. And after Fats Domino became too big, Billy just retired. He told me one time they were doing a show in New Orleans, and they featured, his name was Antoine, and they called him Antoine the Fat Man. And one night they did a show, and Antoine was so on that they tore the audience up, and when he came off stage, everybody said, man, you performed like Fats Waller out there, man. You something else. And Billy Diamond said, I'm going to call you Fats Domino. And that stuck. So imagine this. All these years later, I used to go over and talk to Billy. Billy lived next door to one of my best friends in my neighborhood. Mm-hmm. He told me the whole trip about how he and his brother-in-law drove from New Orleans to Los Angeles with their wives, and they just kind of relocated out here. Billy would tell me stories that I just couldn't believe, because he was much older than Paul. And we were at that place in Bakersfield doing the show, and as soon as Paul stopped talking with Fats, because they talked about touring in the 50s when they were all young, and, you know, Fats looked so good. He looked like a newborn baby in the face. He was so well taken care of. And he came out and Paul and him embraced, and they talked. And I waited my turn. I said, Fats, I'm a friend of Billy Diamond. He said, man, where is Billy? And I said, well, I was going to bring him to this show, but it was a long drive, you know. And he said, man, he said, you know Billy gave me my name? Do you know he titled me Fats Domino? And I said, isn't that amazing? And because I had heard Billy tell me that before.
Right, small world in the way that story
came around. What a small world.
Came around.
You know what? Those things aren't like accidents. Those are things, and we say small world, but that was something that was supposed to happen. Fats Domino ended up calling me Platter Man.
Every time. That's funny.
Years after Paul passed away, and I kept going with the group, we did shows. We did a big show in Albuquerque, New Mexico, and I walked up to Fats, and he hugged me now, and he had Platter Man. That is so awesome, you know. So that's what my book is about, talking about things like that and how I got a chance to meet people. Little Anthony is one of my most favorite people in the business because Anthony was just a most down-to-earth guy. And you know, like a mild-mannered reporter like Clark Kent, this guy shows up to a place, and he looks like he's part of the help. He's dressed up, he's cool, he's sharp. But when it comes to him going on stage, man, you better bring a bucket and a mop to clean that stage up after that man leaves. And I had to follow him, you know, as the lead singer of the Platters. And I used to think it was so unfair that anybody would book Anthony on a show and not let him close. But Paul told me once, he said, man, you know what the truth of the matter is? The Platters had more hit records than the Imperials. And I never accepted that. I never liked that idea. I said, because Tony Williams was the actual voice of the success of the Platters, and Anthony was the voice of the Imperials. And Anthony sounded better when I worked with him than he did on his record.
Okay.
So, yeah, that business is crazy. But, again, that's pretty much what I'm talking about in my book. And I'm almost there. I'm almost done. I have to do the cover. And after that, you know, there's a couple of people. You introduced me to a guy, Mike.
Okay.
Mike Harris.
Yes.
He's given me some great tips on what I should do to self-publish it. So.
Right. He did a show with me on self-publishing, and he also is a celebrity photographer down here in the Tampa area.
He is awesome.
Thank you.
He is.
I will agree with that. Well, let me ask you now.
You.
Yeah, let's talk about you. So performing now, I know you performed with the Platters for 21 years. You've traveled all over the world. You know, you've done everything. Do you still perform?
Yeah, I left the Platters in 1999 because Paul was deceased. The management of the Platters had gone, I mean, told Greedville. And it was nothing that interested me at all. And I had little boys. My two sons, two youngest sons, were little guys, and they needed me at home. And I said to myself once, I was sitting in Singapore going bananas, thinking, man, who's going to pick my kids up? My wife's taking law classes, and, you know, who's going to pick my kids up and be with them? And I couldn't handle the road knowing that my little boys were not with Dad. So I had to, you know, it was that time. It was, they didn't ask to be born into this world. And I thought the least I could do as a father is to give them the best attention that I possibly can, with money or without, without a schedule. So I left them, and in 1999, I got a call from John Mills. He was the son of the last living member of the Mills brothers. Donald Mills was the youngest member and the last living member. And John called me, and he said, man, my dad is really ill. He's got a brain tumor. And I have a lot of bookings that I can't, you know, get out of. And a mutual friend of ours, John Wood, whose father was Randy Wood of Dot Records, he had John call me. And John said, if you could just sit with me and let me tell you about my show and tell you what I need to have done, maybe you could help me out. And I told him at that time, I'll help you until you get the right guy. Because I love the Mills Brothers music, and I remember how much Paul Robey talked about the Mills Brothers. Literally every trip I ever went on with Paul, he brought up the Mills Brothers because they were the granddaddies of vocal groups and their harmonies and their camaraderie. They were an awesome family group, you know. So I met with John, and I told him I would do the best I could, and it was a struggle because my job was singing songs that were in a much higher range, which made it easy because the Mills Brothers songs were recorded in my speaking voice. So that wasn't so hard. And that's what I've been doing since 99, actually, is singing with John Mills and his Mills Brothers group.
Now, what is it that you love the most about being a singer?
I think it's because I never was so great at school. I never got degrees, finished a lot of courses. I studied computer science and stuff like that. And, you know, it wasn't until I was older. But when I was a kid, I didn't get much approval from anything. And my family was a pretty, poor family. So singing gave me the proof that if you work hard and you really, really study your craft, the response that you get from the audience is that's the best I can do to describe it. If you do your work.
Was it strange when you first started doing this to get up in front of people? How did the fame part of it hit you? Was it strange?
It was, and I was so self-centered to say, don't let this go to your head. I was so in control that I did not make the Platters' early hits. I wasn't the guy on the record. So I'm doing my rendition, working with Paul and keeping his group going. And it was awkward because I played guitar for so many years, and I still love holding the guitar and playing it, but I don't get the sense of the reward for the hard work because I'm really a singer, and I realize that I sit at the piano and I play songs. I have a cello. I study cello scales, and all of that's basically comparison to the human voice. So I handled the fame part really well because I knew that they were coming to hear the Platters, not Elmer Hopper.
Gotcha. Yeah, and you're pretty down to earth, I think.
Well, you know, like I said, I'm glad that it happened the way it did because I never was a boasted type person. I never was braggadocious about stuff. I like nowadays, I'm older, and I get really to the facts of how things are. And, of course, I love the idea of the singer's job. But to me, I didn't grow up around people from New York and great entertainers. Paul was the most successful and the most talented person that I had ever met in the beginning, and I realized that I wasn't at his level, so there was no point in acting as if I was great, you know. And I don't like people who are like that anyway, personally. And some people have the right to be, you know, great. Billy Eckstein had a way about him that was so refined and just so magical that I can't even describe. Of my first vision of watching Billy, I was sitting in the audience in Australia in a place called the St. George Leagues Club in Australia with Paul and his wife and the other members of the Platters. And Billy Eckstein walked on the stage, and I saw Paul as if he was taking notes. That's how great Billy Eckstein was.
Good. So
to get to that level. You know, every once in a while people get lucky, I think. And Billy Eckstein would sit down, and he was no different than I am. And I liked that. I liked his humbleness about him. And the way Billy cursed, he had language problems. That man could cuss.
Well, before we close out, how can people get a hold of you? And, you know, I know you're writing the book. Is there a completion date for the book?
No, there's no completion date. They can call the police to get in touch with me. Go to the post office and look for my picture. No, I have a website called ElmerHopper.com. And you can email at Elmer@ElmerHopper.com or ElmerHopper@gmail.com or ElmerHopper@yahoo.com. I'm easy to get in touch with if anybody wants to bother.
Gotcha. Now, one of the last things I want to talk about, because I think it's important, is advice. What kind of advice would you give to somebody who wanted a career in music, you know, in singing and performing? Because I think it's a tough market nowadays, especially it's become so commercialized with the videos and things like that. So what advice would you give?
I would say focus in on successful artists that you admire. Find a coach or a teacher or both and really study. And there's something called the language of our trade. It's called reading music. Learn to read music so that if a musical director or a choir director or a vocal arranger, somebody says, okay, I've got a gun up to your head, go and touch middle C on the piano. Just so that you don't lose your life over not knowing where middle C is. Mm-hmm. Learn the notes. I don't know how many octaves on a piano, but there's only from C to C, 8 notes. They repeat themselves
right.
In various places, from low to high. Learn one of those octaves and learn what a C note looks like, a D note, and on until you know a scale. And practice finding where your range is. That's the best advice that I could think to tell anyone.
Okay, very good. I want to thank you for joining me. What we're going to do is we're going to go out with one of your songs. I appreciate you joining me again.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, thank you so much. I always enjoy talking to you. And we'll be back next week on The World of Lori Zook.
May they still be the same.